Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, March 18th, 2006, and I'm Harley Schlanger. I'll be your host today. There's been a really dramatic series of developments in the last 48 hours that represents a possible phase shift away from the George Shultz-Dick Cheney permanent war scenario in the Mideast. First, it was announced that there will be direct talks between diplomats from Iran and the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, Khalilzad, to discuss Iranian help to stabilize the situation in Iraq. This is a very significant development. It's the first official contact between the U.S. and Iran since the hostage crisis in 1980, and it is a recognition that the situation in Iraq is out of control. Remember, Khalilzad is an inner core of the neocons who wanted the war with Iraq, and his statements that he wants this discussion shows that he's come to realize that the situation is devolving rapidly. Now, secondly, there was the formation this week of the Iraq Study Group with officials from the Reagan administration, Bush 1, and Clinton. People such as William Perry, who was the defense secretary under Clinton, Vernon Jordan, who was a top advisor to Clinton, Robert Gates, who was CIA director under Bush 1, and also Alan Simpson, former senator from Wyoming, who was a very strong Reaganite. They're forming a bipartisan grouping to figure a way out of this collapse into permanent warfare in the Middle East. And at their initial presentation on a Wednesday press conference, they gave real indications that they're moving in the direction outlined more than 2 years ago by Lyndon LaRouche in his strategic economic perspective called the LaRouche Doctrine for Southwest Asia. And the third of these developments was that Iran played the LaRouche card. Lyndon LaRouche was interviewed on Iranian radio this week. It was a very concise series of formulations from Mr. LaRouche, including the opening question of the British role in setting up the United States in the so-called Iran crisis. LaRouche secondly went through how this is contrary to U.S. interests. And then, interestingly, with a kind of prescience that you get from Lyndon LaRouche, he discussed that there's a split developing between Bush and Cheney. Now, we're not exactly talking about something on the level of Leibniz-Clark or Einstein-Born, especially when you deal with these two knuckleheads. But what LaRouche pointed to is, in fact, that the situation is moving out of their control with developments from Russia and from the Islamic world, and also with some input from Germany. Now, on the other side, the Shultz faction of the Syndicus financial elites want war. They're, through Cheney, through Bolton, through their Israeli tool, Bibi Netanyahu, they're pushing for a new crusade. With us on the LaRouche Show today to discuss these developments in their full historical significance is Jerry Rose. Hopefully many of you heard Jerry when he was our guest on February 4th, and we had a fascinating dialogue on winning the battle against sophistry, the lesson of the Peloponnesian War. If you did miss that, the show is archived on LaRouchePub.com. We'll also be joined by a LaRouche Youth Movement panel. Today we have Ed Hamler from Boston, David DeBroat from Seattle, and Ligaya Rebolos in Los Angeles. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hi, Harley.
Well, as you know, Jerry, one of the interesting things about history is that many people choose to forget it, ignore it, or pretend it's insignificant. But to truly understand how to get out of a crisis like this, it's indispensable to understand what precedents there are, and most importantly, not the specific precedents, but the axiomatic assumptions that led to these crises. But let's begin with this nuclear saber rattling that went on at the March 7th APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee conference in Washington, D.C., which I believe you characterize as a Mad Hatter's ball. You had Cheney in particular coming close to issuing a threat of a nuclear strike against Iran. Bibi Netanyahu was waving his arms around and imitating Bush in his discussion of terrorism. What do these Shultzians want? Why won't they or can't they learn the lesson of the ongoing debacle in Iraq?
Well, I think the reason I characterize it as the Mad Hatter's ball is because Bibi Netanyahu actually, remember, this is the American Israel Committee, right? And presumably it's in the interest of presumably the Jewish population. And in the course of his talk, Bibi Netanyahu said that the Muslims have never forgiven the West for Poitiers, where the Muslims from the South were stopped by Charles Martel from coming up into Spain, further up into Spain. And, of course, the Battle of Lepanto, in which the Turkish fleet was defeated by sort of a
Spanish.
Holy Alliance, the Spanish with others, right? Now, and this is a very direct reference to the Crusades. Now, it was well known, and all the books have it, that when the initial Crusade was preached by Urban II in 1096, the first action before they got to the Holy Land was to kill a number of Jews throughout Europe in a wild anti-Semitic pogroms that went on in just in the spirit of the Holy War, right? And they did this to expropriate the property of Jewish merchants throughout Europe. And they killed a bunch of Jews just to get into the spirit of things, right? So this was well known. That not only Muslims, but Jews were targeted by the Crusades. One of the most dramatic developments is when these Christians, so-called Christians, invaded the Holy Land, the Jews and the Muslims got together to stop them from killing and murdering wantonly Jews and Muslims. That, in fact, Jews and Muslims fought together against this really fundy crusaders, right? So therefore, for Bibi Netanyahu to call for a crusade against Muslims is pretty much a Mad Hatter's ball, because, as I said, it was well known. The unleashing of anti-Semitism, real hardcore religious anti-Semitism, came in the wake of the call, the initial call for the Crusades, and went throughout Europe for centuries. Now, the more and more I study classical drama, the more and more I see that these are strategic studies. There is a very famous play called The Jew of Malta by Marlowe, Christopher Marlowe, in which the subject of the play is the Crusades. And indeed, on the island of Malta, the governor Farnese, who is a Knights Templar, has to pay tribute to a Turkish sultan. And the first act to pay tribute to the sultan is to take half of the property of every Jew on the island of Malta, every Jewish merchant on the island of Malta. And one of the Jews, Barabbas, protests. And what occurs in the wake of his protesting is that the governor, Farnese, takes every single everything, not just half his treasury, everything, and turns his house into a monastery, his treasure house into a monastery. Now, through the course of play, Barabbas gets revenge, and he revenges himself on the greed of both the Knights Templar, who stole his money and tried to steal his daughter. He also revenges himself on the greed of the Sultan, who was going to invade because they didn't get their tribute. He also, and both the Knights Templar and the Sultan get together to exact revenge on Barabbas at the end. And it's a scene of greed, of treachery, of power, naked raw power and treachery.
Well, Jerry, I think it's reasonable to assume that neither Bush nor Cheney have read Marlowe's play. But one of the points that Lyndon LaRouche has made consistently is that while religious war seems to be one of the favorite tactics used by the oligarchs throughout history, it's really not about religion, is it?
No, it never has been. And in fact, the way that Lynn has discussed it, and it's quite a brilliant historic insight, is that what the Crusades were a devilish combination of Venetian financial interests and the Norman chivalry. And the way that this worked was that that up until the initial preaching of the Crusade by Pope Urban II in 1096 at the Benedictine monastery, and this has implications at Clermont, called Cluny, the Cluniacs, right, which is the Cluniac monastery, Cluny. It was a place in France. Up until then, the normal doctrine of the church was defined by St. Augustine as the concept of just war. While a Christian was even called upon at times to turn the other cheek, an individual Christian or an individual Christian would never exact death against their neighbor. There were circumstances, as Augustine defined, where nations, where millions of people's lives are on the line, had a right to defend themselves, and it could only be defensive, and that the only aim of war was a just peace. Okay? In other words, you could not exact war out of revenge, out of need for territory, out of economic disaster in your own country. You could only fight war defensively to the aim of a just peace for yourself and the person you fought. And that would be, and that you could win, that you had some chance of winning, by the way, right? And that was church doctrine, official church doctrine, up until the preaching of the First Crusade by Urban II and the Benedictines.
All right, Jerry, we'll come right back to that in a second. I just want to inform our viewers that we will be taking email questions on this strategic historical investigation of the insanity of the permanent war doctrine of Schultz and Cheney. You can send us your emails at radio@larouchepub.com. That's LaroucheePub.com. Also, there will be referring to several articles in recent Executive Intelligence Review magazines on the AIPAC meeting and on the background of the Middle East crisis, as well as what some of the other topics that will come up today. And you can contact us for those at 888-347-3258. You're listening to Jerry Rose, and we're discussing the Mad Hatter's Ball, the idea that a new crusade is somehow in the interests of the United States. Now, Jerry, this, as you were just describing, this rejection of the concept of just war and replacement of this as a kind of permanent warfare, this actually does go far beyond even Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations to a new dark age. Why don't you go ahead with your...
Sure. That's exactly where it led. Now, the initial so-called justification for the First Crusade was that we must liberate Jerusalem, the birthplace or the death where Christ was buried. We must liberate Jerusalem from the infidels, from the pagans, right, which are Jews and Muslims. Now, this was a total fraud. And not only did they preach it from the pulpit, but he went out into a mass audience that was whipped up by a guy by the name of Peter the Hermit, who was a populist ranter, right, that drew several tens of thousands of people. They had a one-year organizing drive to bring them to this Benedictine abbey. And the Pope preached a sermon saying anyone who would go to the Holy Land and liberate the Holy Land, pilgrim and particularly knights, soldiers, right, would be absolved of all their sins. And not only would they be absolved of all their sins that they will commit in the course of liberating the Holy Land, but they have ever committed.
That's a pretty good deal.
It was a good deal. But that was the original sort of justification, and it was not very real. Because the reality is that by the there was crusades launched in Spain. This had nothing to do with Jerusalem, against the Muslims, the Moorish population, and the Jewish populations of Spain. And there were crusades launched against Christian heretics, the Albigensian Crusades. Mm-hmm. But the most ironic crusade of all, the one that Venice led with a vengeance, it organized and led it, was the Fourth Crusade, in which they attacked Byzantium or Constantinople, right, which was all Christian. So it had nothing to do with Muslims or Jews or religion. The Fourth Crusade was such an embarrassment that the Pope had to actually apologize for it. This was an attack on a Christian city. It was looted and burned to the ground. It was Venice had convinced these Frankish knights. When I say Frankish knights, you're talking about mainly from France and from England. Remember, this idea of Norman chivalry was when William the Conqueror took over England. This was a French invasion of England, and therefore they imposed a Norman knighthood on and chivalric codes, which I'll get to in a minute, on England. Okay, they were Saxons before then and actual Christians. But when the Normans invaded, this was a whole other story, right? But the point to be made about all this is that it all comes to roost in the Fourth Crusade, in which Venice had organized these Frankish knights, because there were only two routes to the Holy Land. You could go... The first crusade was led overland through Constantinople, up north and then further south to get to Jerusalem. Mm? But the other crusades had to go through the ports, particularly Venice, who would carry the knights and the horses and the provisions through a large fleet. And the one thing that Venice had was that what they call the arsenal, which is where they produced the largest fleet in the world. That was the only productive activity in Venice, besides that was the only thing that even smacked of production in Venice. But this was a mercantile looting operation. And therefore, in the Fourth Crusade, the Venetians, rather than, they said they were going to attack Egypt, so everybody piled on the boat. And the Doge of Venice, Morosini, turned the ships north and attacked Constantinople. Constantinople was the largest Christian city in the world. It had 400,000 people. Venice was only 60,000. That was the third or fourth largest city in the world, and I wouldn't call it Christian either. Right. So the big crusade, and they stole everything in Constantinople, including the two lions which stand in front of St. Mark's Church. And if you notice, the top of St. Mark's Church in Venice has these funny Turkish or Byzantine spire or domes.
Spires,
domes, whatever, right? Stolen from Constantinople. Mm. And they killed about 20,000 Christians or 30,000 Christians in the course of the Fourth Crusade, and took everything that was movable into Venice, plus the Frankish knights who ran the operation, the French kings and others who ran the operation, owed Venice hundreds of thousands of 100,000, 85,000, what they call gold florins or livres, whatever, which was an enormous amount of money. So they bankrupted both the knights who fought the crusade, the countries that funded the knights who fought the crusades. They bankrupted and stole everything from Constantinople. Plus, they established through the Crusades, this is how Venice established its rule. Through these Crusades, they were able to loot all of Europe through taxing or having the knights pay for the Crusades, and these English kings and French kings and Sicilian kings and all these other kings pay for the Crusades. To who? To Venice.
So, Jerry, to get this absolutely clear to the listeners, and I understand I said viewers earlier. If any of you are viewing Jerry Rose, you probably are a spoonbender. But anyway, to the listeners, what we're talking about then is that this looting operation, this genocidal attack in the name of Christianity, destroyed nation states or the potential for nation states. It went against the actual teachings of the Christian Church. And it built the power of Venice. Now,
yes, it was very specific. You see, there was a nascent potential under Charlemagne and then later the Hohenstaufen monarchies, which were trying to establish secular societies based upon an idea of education, an idea of these fairs which would actually distribute books, would distribute new technologies. They were organizing within language groupings, right? The beginnings of nation states. And the ultramontane factions, and I'll go through that in a second, the so-called universal church, right, which was nothing but an empire. Remember, the Roman Empire collapsed and formed two sides to it, one in Constantinople, another in Rome, okay? And then Rome collapsed, and a lot of the Roman families moved into Venice with their money because it was defensible, because it was islands, and you only had to defend it by water, right? So they became a defensible position of the old Roman nobility from the old Roman Senate, who made believe they were Christians under Constantine. Then there was the famous donation of Constantine, which was found in the 8th century, which was a supposed document written in the 4th century by Constantine himself, in which he said that on earth, the ruler is dominated by the papacy, right? This turned out to be a forgery, which was discovered so by Lorenzo Valla, who was organized by the Byzantines as part of the Council of Florence, right? He discovered it was a forgery. But that so-called donation of Constantine wasn't discovered to be a forgery until the 1400s.
So that right? means it was in reality for over 1,000 years.
Yes, over 1,000 years. And what the argument was, which Venice played to the hilt, remember this is the old Roman nobility, was that there could be only one form of government. That form of government must be out of the papacy, through the churches, there would be a worldwide empire, theocratic empire, right? Now, because Alcuin and others were real Christians, and the Augustinians were of a totally different stripe, you had under people like Charlemagne and then later the Hohenstaufen, who were working actually with the Baghdad Caliphates, right, were forming the basis for secular society based upon language groupings, a common history, a common mission, a common purpose, a commonwealth.
So at this point, when the Crusades were being launched, you actually had around these pockets of learning, a potential for a break from the dark age that resulted from the fall of the Roman Empire.
Absolutely. And what this really was, the Crusades, was a consolidation and a crushing of all the potential nation-state in Europe. In other words, it was a pretext, because any king that would not send their knights and their vassals to fight a crusade preached by the Pope would preach a crusade against that king. That it was an internal policing apparatus to loot through the church apparatus all the peasants, all the knights, all the kings, for who? For Venice. Because all the actual bankers for the papacy, which is how Venice consolidated its power, was they were the bankers for the papacy.
Hmm? And Jerry.
And they also consolidated all the routes, all the trade from the east was consolidated after the crushing of Constantinople. So so Venice consolidated its power during the Crusades. Now, here's the irony of ironies, the kicker of kickers. Typical Venetian. Do you know who their allies were in this after the Fourth Crusade?
Go ahead.
The Khans, the Tartars, the Mongols. The Mongols were the policing apparatus, the fascist policing apparatus of the whole East, worked with Venice to loot China, to loot the Caucasus, to loot Kiev, to loot the Holy Lands, so that that Venice consolidated its trade with Genghis Khan. So the great Christian Crusades were an alliance of Norman chivalry, which we'll get into in a minute, Venetian financial oligarchism, and fascist hordes, Tartar hordes, destroying civilization. This all led, by 1348, to what we know to be one of the worst genocides in history, called the Dark Age. That's where the Crusades led.
And the 1348 is a reference to the bankruptcy of the Western banks.
Yeah, the Barney Perugia banks.
The Black Plague. Plague. Yeah.
That's right. And therefore, this whole thing was a fraud, but an interesting fraud.
Now, we're going to have to go to a break in just a second, yeah. Jerry, but it's... What's interesting to me is that if people actually know history, as you've just presented it, it's very transparent that while Cheney and Bush may not know what they're doing, there are people who have studied this, and this is a blueprint. Not exact blueprint, but in terms of the axioms. So we'll come back to this and Norman chivalry and the implications and also the Lim panel in just a moment. You're listening to The LaRouche Show, which is live on the web every Saturday from 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Time. You can call us to get some literature, to be in touch with us, to get the new platform that's been drafted by Lyndon LaRouche at 888-347-3258. You can also contribute to the organizing of the LaRouche Youth Movement through donations to LaRouche PAC. And that number again is 888-347-3258. If there has been a show that you wanted to hear but you missed, you can go to the archives of the LaRouche Show. We're on LaRouchePub.com. And I want to give you a heads up today that on April 27th, we'll have the next Strategic International Webcast by Lyndon LaRouche. That there will be a six-week mobilizing drive to bring down Cheney. And I'm serious, 6 weeks to bring down Cheney so that we can clear this new Dark Age crowd out and begin the process of revitalizing U.S. industry and infrastructure and establishing a new global financial system. So you want to start organizing now for that April 27th, 1 p.m. Eastern, webcast from Lyndon LaRouche. So we're back to the LaRouche Show. My guest is Jerry Rose, who's been giving us a fascinating, in-depth, and yet at the same time, relatively clear and simple strategic picture of the idiocy of the original Crusades and the thinking of the about the new Crusades. Jerry, we have a number of questions on the email that I'll take in a moment, but I want to bring in our LIM panelists who have been patiently listening and probably have some interesting thoughts. Let's start with Ed Hamler in Boston. Ed, you there?
Yeah, hey, Harley.
How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well, pretty well. One thing I was thinking, because we're just now getting out this Democratic Party platform that LaRouche just commissioned for the Democratic Party and for the population, and just bearing on the discussion, there's a huge section, I think one of the first sections, on the issue of the Synarchist International. And really looking at the kinds of things that we see going on in the economy, you know, the destruction of the physical economy infrastructure. You're looking at what the hedge funds are trying to do with General Motors, you know, eat them up and, you know, spit out the the excess. It does remind me a lot of what Jerry was talking about. Because what LaRouche brings up is that you do have a financier oligarchy today, which in part are using people like Cheney, you know, like Jack Straw in Britain, to launch another crusade against Islam today for the explicit purpose of destroying the sovereignty of the United States. Because the only nation that would be able to reorganize this kind of system would be our nation. And I think anybody in government would know that a war with Iran would mean pretty much like the bankruptcy of the United States dollar. There's certain implications of the history Jerry laid out that we're trying to bring to the streets when we organize. In Boston in particular, we had some meetings with the State House. And these were interesting meetings. We figured out we had a bunch of closet LaRouches, so-called, in the State House, and a lot of support in the population for what Lynn is saying. But I think the issue now is that we have to get the population a sense of who the enemy is that we're fighting.
Mm-hmm.
To give people a sense that economics is not all just ideology. It's not all theory. That you do have people trying to undermine the development of the United States.
Well, Jerry, let me see if Jerry has a thought on that. I'm wondering, Jerry, if you would, taking what Ed said, compare the axiomatics of what you might call the new imperial faction around Schultz with what you've just described.
They're not new. That's the irony.
Yeah.
They're not new.
Yeah.
In other words, this is not an analogy. These are the same people. They've been, you know, Venice morphs into the British financial oligarchy, right? Through a series, it's a whole different discussion. No, this axioms, as you call them, Parley, which is absolutely correct, is the axiomatics of empire.
Mm-hmm.
And the hedge funds are the financial locusts that the Venetian oligarchy ultimately destroyed itself through this process, although they morphed into something else. But they destroyed civilization through this process. They hate civilization.
I find it very interesting, Jerry, when you talk to a proponent of globalization and they say globalization is new. It's based on computers. It's based on high-speed communications and cell phones and we now have something totally new, and you point out that it's precisely the same as the Roman Empire, the Venetian Empire.
Yes, and what's fascinating to me is you really see the total hypocrisy. This was caught brilliantly by three of the greatest writers in history. One, Rabelais. The total hypocrisy of this stuff. There's a very famous aspect of Gargantuan and Pantagruel, which is Friar John. He's a you see, these Knights Templar, the Hospitallers, the Teutonic Knights, these were all chivalric orders, right? They were bloodthirsty cutthroats that stole everything in sight, right? Not every one of them, but the majority of them. But they were given total dispensation. So in Rabelais' discussion in Gargantuan Pantagruel of Friar John, which is very reminiscent of Peter the Hermit, one of these wacko fundies, right? Friar John kills 10,000 men carrying a cross, a wooden cross, a very heavy wooden iron cross, and he kills 10,000 people because they tried to steal his wine. Okay? That's Rabelais' rendition of it. Then Cervantes has a brilliant rendition of this so-called chivalric orders in Don Quixote.
Right.
Right? And then Shakespeare has a brilliant insight in the character of Falstaff, that the total hypocrisy of a Cheney, of, you know, as if they're religious, as if they're Christians, as if this has anything to do with anything but imperial looting. But the poor idiots on the bottom who are manipulated are grotesque. And the only thing, the most brilliant minds of those centuries, Rabelais in particular, others had other indications, made total fun and made a mockery of Norman chivalry. So you get a sense of what this thing is really is.
Jerry, we have an email, just someone who is thanking you. It's from James Calvert saying, thank you and your guest for the exposition of some extremely fascinating history. So I guess there are people out there who still see the importance of history. Let's go to our second LIM panelist from the Northwest Ecotopia of Seattle. We have David DeBroat with us on the phone today. How are you, David?
I'm doing well.
Do you have a question or a comment for Jerry?
Yeah, I was thinking about the organizing we're doing on the West Coast right now in preparation for the California State Democratic Convention, where the entire West Coast youth movement is going to be descending to transform the environment of the convention into one of the most cognitive environments of that weekend on the West Coast. And thinking about the organizing of these Democrats, often when you approach them with a real sense of history, it often can be, especially to them who lack, you know, guts most of the time, quite intimidating, and can feeds their feelings that, you know, it's inevitable that Cheney will start a war with Iran or whatnot. But I was thinking about, on the other hand, though, it's Lynn has made comments recently that the way we're going to move the population, and what I've seen in the organizing, is around organizing them around the positive alternative solution, you know, specifically the infrastructure projects that we're putting on the table right now. So, yeah, I was wondering what sort of comment you had to say about that, Jerry.
Well, history is driven by these positive developments. Remember, the Crusades were a reaction, a violent reaction by this financier oligarchy to the developments around Charlemagne, and then later the Hohenstaufen monarchies working with the Baghdad caliphates. In other words, and then the result of their action of bringing on the Black Death led later to a total destruction and weakening of their power, such that a certain faction around Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, and they had seized the papacy, and established through the Council of Florence the basis for a renaissance, a return to scientific thinking, and the basis of Louis the 11th, and then later the Henry the 7th of England, so that. It's not that evil is a principle of history. It's not. In fact, these reactions tend to be reactions the driving force in history and the general tendency of history has been increases in relative potential population density because it's in the nature of being human. In other words, good is much more powerful than evil. And therefore, the secular tendency for mankind has been an increase in the relative potential population density per square kilometer. And therefore, by no means are these guys inevitable. The only thing inevitable is that if they do, for a brief period of time, dominate a civilization, the only thing inevitable is that that civilization will collapse. But another civilization would take its place, one human, because it's in the nature of the universe itself that the cognition, which is the basis upon which the universe was formed by the Creator, when we say mankind is in the image of the Creator, that's what we're talking about, that is a fundamental universal physical principle. So by no means, in fact, the only thing inevitable is that if mankind refuses to get over sophistry and refuses to learn universal physical principles, then these kinds of things happen. Otherwise, these guys are stupid. They're really stupid. And as Cervantes, as Shakespeare, and Rabelais indicated, they're laughable.
I think also you can add to that list Lyndon LaRouche, who has consistently emphasized that humor and ridicule is one of the best ways to deal with them, as in his recent piece, The Tale of Two Bozos, in which he spoke about Schultz and Roentgen. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. We still have time to take some more emails from you if you'd like to send a question. I'm going to get to a couple of the ones we have up on the board in a minute. Those emails can come to us at radio@larouchepub.com. And if we don't have time on the show, I'll give Jerry some homework. He'll answer your emails if you have specific questions. Let's turn to our third panelist from the LaRouche Youth Movement panel in Los Angeles, Ligaia Robolos. Ligaia, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So what do you have for Jerry?
It's pretty interesting because the population really, they need to know the background on this stuff. Because if they don't, if the population fails to realize the opposition, they really can't flank them, right? They really can't, they don't know how the enemy is thinking, nor do they know who the enemy really is, to come to figure out how to actually flank or take it head on or anything. They can't fight a battle they know nothing about. And so it's
well, this
funny.
Is where Lynn is so brilliant, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, and it's funny because, like you said, it is inevitable that, you know, if the population fails to move, even if it's just a small portion, because there is, civilizations really do collapse, but others will emerge because individuals make a conscious decision to really overcome the period that they live in. And so that's why we're crucial as a youth movement. You know, Lin is emerging in a time of crisis, but the limb, he said, we just got done reading The Power to Prosper, and he said that we're, you know, he's creating a cadre of youth that will not only know what he knows, but will actually know it better. And, you know, it really takes a kind of rigorous or a thorough understanding of where you are in history to then fight for at least the next two generations, as he said. And, you know, it, even though it seems as if we're really overwhelmed with what Schultz and Cheney and these guys are doing, it really does take just key individuals like Lin, King, JFK, you know, Roosevelt, to get us out of the crisis. And that's why we're really doing a lot of the work to find those individuals in the population. To, you know, 200,000 people didn't just decide to wake up one day and join the civil rights movement. They had to be organized. And so that's exactly what we're going to take to the Democratic Convention in the next 4 weeks or so. And so we're going to completely bombard them and say, look, this is how Lynn is able to outline what we're going to fight next, because he has an understanding of the last 5,000 years of history.
Jerry, I guess you and the listeners have had a chance to see that the youth on the West Coast are honing in on the Democratic Party.
Yes, for sure. That's great. That's just great. And that's wonderful. And you're right. The question, it's remember, Lynn discusses this question from the standpoint of this Descartes and this flat earth view of history, right? That somehow you wake up and each day is a new day and, you know, there are no principles embedded in it, right? Whereas we came to the point we're at. This is not a history as analogy or as a moral play, right? These forces that are behind Cheney, behind Schultz, have a very distinct history. And they have been defeated before. And ultimately, they destroy themselves. And therefore, people should get off the sinking ship and join us. But as you point out, you've got to understand who the history of this. Take at least, as Lynn pointed out, from the Peloponnesian Wars and civilization from Solon, as one current history. It's current history. It's not current events. It's current history. And we're at a point where, because of Lynn, because of the LaRouche Youth Movement, because of the support that we're getting, we can finally end this phase of history and move on to a much more beautiful, a much more potent phase for mankind, but we've got to end it.
The whole approach of the development of the LaRouche Youth Movement has been precisely to give people a sense that what happened with the boomer generation was the discontinuity, the break from the past, the attack on the classical culture. When sometimes you get people who say, well, what's wrong with modern music? Well, once you break from the principles that are valid expressions of universal principles, then you lose that connection, that continuity throughout history that led to the development of civilization. And I think this idea of living in history and actually understanding that you can't see what you're doing without having a sense of these kinds of unfoldings, it's not an abstraction at all. And it's thanks to imbeciles and traitors to humanity like Hegel that people see things in a different way. So we have about 12 minutes left, Jerry, and I want to get another email on here and then see if we have some more from our panel for you.
Okay.
So we have a question from the Netherlands.
Oh, okay.
Viron Limberopoulos, who he says, hello, EIR friends, I have a question. What is the influence of ecumenical initiatives of the clergy in the Middle East for diffusing the potential sectarian violence? And he also wants to know about the question of the use of the Kurds to destabilize not just Iraq, but Syria, Iran, and Turkey. So what is going on? Is there an effort from, I know the Vatican has been attempting to do something. What do you know about that, Jerry? Anything?
Well, I think there are some important efforts, right? In other words, under John Paul II's leadership, and now the new pope, who was very close to John Paul, they did apologize for the Crusades. The whole idea of religious war, holy war, was anathema to any real Christian, right? And the majority of Christians find it that way. And therefore, their efforts to bring together Muslim, Jew, and Christian are very useful. They're good initiatives. But in and of themselves, the problem with ecumenicism usually is let's find the lowest common denominator that we can all agree on. And under those circumstances, you're not going to get much done, right? Mm-hmm. What you need to do is establish a universal physical principle called the general welfare. right? And Muslim, Jew, Christian, and pretty much everyone else, there's a science to this, which includes nuclear energy, which includes desalinization, which includes the machine tool principles. There is a science of universal physical principle of the general welfare, right? And one of the problems you have in ecumenical dialogues is that it does not establish that as the basis for such a dialogue. Now, when you do establish that, as Lynn has, remember, there's something very interesting about Lynn addressing the Iranian population in Farsi. There is not one politician, Western politician, American politician, that the Iranian government would trust but Lyndon LaRouche. Now, why is that so? Why do they trust Lynn and no one else? Because Lynn tells the truth. And he tells the truth no matter who is going to get pissed off, no matter how powerful the people who are going to get pissed off hear it, right? How much money they have, what kind of power they think they have. Lynn tells the truth. And therefore, he's taken the ecumenical dialogue into another realm of universal physical principle. And the Iranian government would be very interested in what Lynn is very interested in what Lynn is offering. The Russian government is very interested in what Lynn is offering. The American government, this really, it's not even a bipartisan study group. It's a nonpartisan study group, in fact, right, is very interested. And therefore, if you're going to have ecumenical dialogues, you must establish a universal physical principle which is true for all men and women for all time, for centuries to come. And this is rigorously knowable, as opposed to this touchy-feely, we shouldn't do evil to each other, which we shouldn't do.
But it's also from this standpoint, then, that the ecumenical backup from the churches, for example, as you mentioned, the Vatican, some of the Orthodox churches and others, then have a context in which they can add their voice.
Yes, absolutely.
Jerry, we're really closing in on about 7 minutes, and I'm actually very happy to note that we're getting a lot of emails, so you will answer these, right?
Oh, yes, I promise I will.
Okay, because what I'd like to do is a very quick round to get back to the LaRouche Youth Member panelists again. So, Ed, you have any quick comments?
I did have a question, if that's okay.
Go ahead. We'll just keep Jerry short.
Okay. Well, one thing I'd just like to know was what was the Crusader reaction to, more specifically? I have a general sense of certain things that led up to it, but just certain key things that I guess we can go back and look at later, just from the standpoint of what our work is in the youth movement with the intellectual fight.
In terms of what caused the Crusades, or what in particular?
No, what kind of cultural process was the Crusades' reaction to?
Oh, okay. Well, the best purveyor of this was Petrarch and Dante.
Okay.
In De Monarchia, which was Dante's famous defense of the Hohenstaufen and the Charlemagne against the Black Guelph who ran the papacy, the Cluny, the Benedictine Cluny Church, right, the Cluniacs. Right, Dante was the critical Western thinker that was keying off and creating a fight to understand that the idea, even before the nation states and the development of the, which led into the Council of Florence, Dante was critical in that, in particularly De Monarchia, in which he says you must have a literate language culture. Every part of the world must have a literate language culture, and you must argue in what was called the vernacular, not just Latin, that every people had a language, and that must become strong and literate, capable of conveying, as Shelley pointed out, great ideas with respect to man and nature.
And this is what people like Abelard were involved in. There were others at the time of the Crusades.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, David, you have another question?
Yeah, just on that note, I was thinking about how exciting it's been to get this platform out and Lynn's goal to get out millions in the next 5 or 6 weeks. And this is really, a very powerful flank, similar to what was to create these like learning circles that were taking place, amidst the Crusades that they were trying to crush. And we're trying, this is our way to flank the financial control of the Democratic Party in Washington, D.C. right now.
Okay, I thought you were going to ask Jerry how we're going to fund it. One of the things we can do, let me give our toll-free number again. Call in and order some platforms. We're now set up to send them out, aren't we, Jerry?
Yep, we sure are, yeah.
So call
as many as you want.
Okay, you heard it from Jerry. Call us at 888-347-3258. We have an interesting question from someone who calls himself Thomas Torquemada, but Jerry, I'll let you answer that via email, because I want to get Ligaya in for one
great
last question.
Okay,
from the
great
panel. Ligaya?
I just wanted to ask really quick about how do you actually, or during the Democratic State Convention, how do we actually get people to move in terms of actually joining the caucuses and stuff like that? How do we get them to realize that it's not only Cheney, or it's not just the Democrats that need the guts, but the population, that they need to help give the population guts also?
Harley, I'm going to let you answer that one because you're on the ground on that one.
Well, I think it's what we're talking about. You have to challenge people. You look, what Lyndon LaRouche attempted with the Prolegomena was to create a discussion document. It's not a platform per se. It's a discussion document that can raise all the kinds of profound questions we've taken up here in the last hour. People need to know these things. It's not just that we need a new dam or a road or a railroad. We need to think differently. People need to comprehend what it means to be human. And that's what Jerry's discussing. This is what Cheney and others are out to destroy, the potential for people to see the benefit of institutions of self-government which act on behalf of the general welfare. How do you know what the general welfare is? It's not that we need just simply a new dam here, or that we need a bill to provide cheaper drugs for seniors. We need a whole new way of thinking that goes back to the ideas of the founding fathers and Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt. And what the LaRouche Youth Movement does when it does the best is challenges the hell out of everyone, not just Democrats, but everyone, to rethink what it means to be a human being. So I think the best way to do it is to take the platform and go out and challenge people. Jerry, we have 2 minutes left, and what I'd like you to do is just kind of summarize what you've been discussing.
Sure. I think this question of where this Cheney, Schultz, Venetian faction in London come from, right? In other words, there is a punchline on all this, right? Their system has never worked. In this particular case, it led to what was called the Black Death. But the so-called Christians worked with Genghis Khan to loot China, Southeast, Southwest Asia, to set up one international monetary system, to loot the idiot knights and other fools who played the game, when these systems have never, ever, in all of mankind, worked.
And unfortunately, we've not yet defeated them.
So that's what we're up to. And it's very useful to know these kinds of things as a current history. You know, Lynn has defined this phase space as taking it from Solon of Athens to today, right, through these different phases. And that's what you bring to bear on understanding every single contemporary political problem that we have.
And that's where our authority comes from vis-a-vis any party or institution. Well, Jerry, thank you very much. It's been quite enjoyable again for me and obviously for the listeners because we still have more emails coming in.
Great. Okay.
LaGaia, Dave, and Ed, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
And I'd like to thank the listeners. Join us next week for the LaRouche Show.
Okay. We'll see you.
Okay.
Bye.